Impro Mafia presents And Time!
Welcome to And Time, a podcast for improvisers and aspiring improvisers. I'm Dan Beeston, Impro Mafia's resident tech guy and designer.
And I'm Deborah Frances White.
Deborah, why not introduce yourself to the audience? What is it that you do improvise?
I co-founded the Spontaneity Shop, which we like to think is the UK's premier improvisation company. It's based in London, and it's been running 11 years. We now have an office, and I work there with Alex McLaren and Tom Selinsky. A big shout-out to the boys.
What sort of office is it? Are we looking at like a little tiny room like that's all the way down the back and of a building in like six stories of...
No.
This is like a huge atrium with like a pool in the front foyer.
Neither of those.
Somewhere in the centre?
Yeah, it's a kind of a cool office building in Camden Town, which is a funky North London suburb. And it's kind of quite a mod office, but everyone else in that office building is a sort of a small creative company as well. It has a reception desk and a shared reception area and shared cool breakout rooms and things like that. But most people in there are doing some kind of funky PR or music or something like that. And we're one of the companies in there. And there's three of us in there all the time. And then we have other staff that come in and do freelance stuff for us as well.
Oh, nice. That's a big step up from the back room of Wade's, Queenslander.
Sure. We've only had that office for a few years and we've been going for 11 years. But we do a lot of corporate training now and corporate entertainment, so we
actually make money.
Office. We actually make money, yeah. And we do workshops. We have a very flourishing workshop program that is oversubscribed and makes money. And we also do shows. We did a show this year in the Edinburgh Festival. We do fairly regular shows in London. So the shows are always, as you know, unless you do a sort of a special show, less financially viable than doing workshops or training, but they're so much fun to do. And they make the whole thing tick over, the sort of point of doing everything, really.
Indeed. So that's who you're listening to, listeners. So what's been going on in the world of impro in the last week? Well, you're out here in Australia doing some training and such.
Yes, I've been doing some corporate training, and I've been on Hamilton Island working with a company there, helping them to be more charismatic through improvisation. So basically, we started off with improvisation techniques, and we developed them into things that companies would actually want to use. So we have something called the Charisma Key, which is based in improvisational training.
And the Charisma Key.
The Charisma Key, helping people be more charismatic. And so I did 2 days work for them, just doing some keynote speaking at their convention.
Yep.
And then I did my stand-up show on Hamilton Island, which is called How to Get Almost Anyone to Want to Sleep With You. And I'm doing that show again tonight in Brisbane at the Stage Door Theatre.
I'll be there. But of course, this won't be edited by that point. So you just missed it, listeners.
Excellent.
But you'll have to catch it next time. Or fly to London.
Sure. Or, I tour around. So watch out on the almostanyone.co.uk website.
Lovely. Now, it says almost everyone. Are the ones that don't, is that a part of the show? Am I going to find out about that, or should I find out now?
Almost anyone is because it's partly because most people I know spend 99% of their time trying to convince the one person who doesn't want to sleep with them that they really do. And it's about sexual confidence, about feeling really good about yourself and saying, hey, I'm really sexy, and getting out there rather than obsessing about, oh, why doesn't he like me? Like, just realizing how many people do find you attractive if you act as if you are attractive.
Nice. Oh, I can't wait. I'm excited about it.
Looking forward to having you. Not in that way.
It's a double entendre. What have I been? Impro Mafia has been busy, a little bit busy recently, with Her Majesty's Improvisers show, which was our maestro show on Sunday night. And the playing went well. I found that the playing was quite good in the show, but it was one of those nights where the audiences... I've got a theory about audiences, is that there's a critical mass of audience that's dependent on the size of the room and the type of the room. So generally that critical mass in most of our theatres is around about 25. And after 25, the energy in the room is self-sustaining and the audience sustains their own amount of enthusiasm. But anything under that, and the players tend to have to feed them that energy, and that can be very tiring.
I think that's a fair assessment of the situation in most places, depending on the size of the room.
Yeah. I was absolutely stuffed at the end of the last show. And oddly enough, during the show, I felt like it wasn't going very well. Then after the show, I was like, actually, that was a really strong set of performances. But yeah, I am hoping that the next show there will have a larger audience. But
didn't you have the AFL final on that day, so that's why there weren't many people there?
Possibly. I don't know what the demographic crossover, though, is.
Well, big football finals anywhere tend to be... Like, I don't watch football, but if England's playing Germany, then of course I will. Like, it's so I think those big matches will step on your audience. So I don't think you should be too downhearted.
I don't want those audience members coming back anyway, choosing football over us.
But that's probably not a wise thing to say on your podcast, really, seriously. You want anyone who will come who is interested in seeing your show who will be there. So I think rewind to that. I think this, a formal apology is now necessary.
This marketing thing is sort of... Okay, it's all new to me.
Yeah.
Don't offend the audience. Don't
piss them off.
Okay.
It's just not worth it.
Gee, that kind of takes a lot of my shtick out of the podcast.
Sure. I'm really sorry about that.
I have to do some retraining.
Yeah, you could mock the performers or perhaps the whole notion of improvisation itself.
Oh, no, I've been mocking the performers for the last couple of weeks. I seem to have made a lot of enemies.
Sure.
No, that was my first... The first thing I learned.
So this show, Her Majesty's Secret Improvisers, was it called?
Yes.
And that was a James Bond theme?
It was. Wade and I were discussing it early on, and we got a little bit too keen and came up with the notion of actually having a supervillain take over the venue halfway through the show and tie up the MC.
Sounds fun.
Which was... most of our Maestro shows have been very much, here's the beginning, here's all the scenes, here's the end. Here's like a flavour to the whole night that's generally... old English themed, because Nat and Wade are in control and they love that stuff. So we've had Tawny of Impro and people in red coats, you know, lots of English type stuff, and then this one was also in sort of that British spy genre, and we got a bit keen about throwing the audience some curveballs and making the show pop out of the mold that it had created. And so we had, instead of ending the show, we actually had guerrilla tacticians running in at the last minute and taking over the venue, closing the curtains and helping the audience out of the venue to make sure that they weren't killed.
And did that work out?
It seemed to. It was hard to tell with that small audience. And because they weren't sustaining their own enthusiasm, I think they were also a bit creeped out by the fact that they weren't quite sure where anything was coming from.
Sure. So it needed a few more people in the house to make that truly successful.
I don't like to blame the number of audience or the enthusiasm of the audience for the show's.
Sure, but if you're going to do something like that that's really interactive, sometimes it can help to have a bigger house.
Indeed, certain elements seemed to go off quite well. The audience seemed excited to see the notion that the MC was suddenly taken out of the game and someone else had turned up. They'd never seen this person before. It was an old improviser who hasn't been in the game for about 8 years. But he fills out a Dr. Evil costume perfectly.
Excellent.
So, and has his own. So,
sounds like fun.
Indeed. So it was a lot of fun. We had sound effects and helicopter noises and just wanted to keep the audience on the back foot and make it so that they would be talking about the show afterwards and going, you've got to see this show. It was really crazy. Halfway through, someone came in, took over the venue, rather than just, oh, we just went to an improv show.
Yeah.
But when it comes down to it, it really is the playing that has to be good. If people aren't talking about the playing then and how much fun they're having watching the improv show, then I can't help but feel that whatever handle you put on it is not going to be enough.
But you said that the performances were good, though.
Yes.
Sounds like a successful night all round, then, if the performances were good and the stunt that you pulled was fun as well. Because I think it doesn't help to mix things up like that for variety.
Yeah.
To give the audience some theatre once in a while. Because I think we tend to turn up in our jeans and rock out a few scenes and then go to the bar, and something that's a little bit more theatrical sometimes can feed the enthusiasm of the audience to want to come back, because they think you've put some production values into it and it felt like an experience rather than just those people were being amusing each other.
I hope so. Oh, and of course, last night we did a character workshop with you.
That's right, it was with me.
Which was lots of fun. I have been telling our new rookies that my most important rule in performance is picking your character to complement what is going on stage.
Sure.
I find that that's always helped me to jump up on stage and fill that sort of void that's happening up there. But your workshop went into that in a little bit more depth about finding characters who, not only characters who complement what's going on the stage, but complement it in a way that creates a new form of, a new character, a new way of playing the character or the stereotype.
Sure. Well, the stuff that I was doing yesterday was, Tom and I wrote a book called The Improv Handbook, which is available on Amazon at the moment, and by Deborah Francis White and Tom Zielinski, The Improv Handbook. Check it out. And there's a chapter in there about character, and one of the techniques that I've developed is called Arbitrary Opposite Extreme, in which we, for example, I get people to start off playing a parking inspector or a traffic warden, someone who gives tickets to cars that are parked incorrectly, and depending on where you're listening from. And the... I always get people to do a couple of scenes before I say anything, and invariably the scenes are always the same. Are you giving my car a ticket? Yes, I am. Oh, but I was only 2 minutes late. Oh, but still it was illegally parked. Please don't give me a ticket. I have to give you a ticket. And it always starts like that. It starts very locked. A lot of bargaining. Always the cliched parking inspector who's unreasonable or quite enjoys giving a ticket.
Mm-hmm.
Always the same person coming back to their car. And this is, I think, because as improvisers, we don't have time to sense. We don't want to censor. We want to trust what's obvious to us.
Yep.
We want to rush out and go with our obvious. But our obvious about what a parking inspector is like is the same all over the world. It's cliched.
Mm.
And so we go for that cliche. And so we end up in the same scene again and again and again and again in the cliche. And so this technique is hopefully to unlock that without getting us to be clever or try really hard to be interesting. And so the technique is, what do you think of when you think of a parking inspector? What adjectives would you use to describe someone who does that? Well, unreasonable, officious, and irritated. And so what's the opposite of that? Reasonable, relaxed, and happy. And so then start playing the parking inspector the opposite of what you'd think and see where that goes. And that's the start of this technique.
I remember being taught to go for the obvious, and that's a fairly common rule for people who are starting up, I found. But recently I was doing a workshop with Paddy Stiles,
mm-hmm.
and I understand that some rules are very specific to certain parts of the world, but she was saying that certain basic things that, my fundamentals that I was taught in the very beginning, she goes, oh, those aren't really, we don't teach those fundamentals either, and something like not wimping or something. Because I remember being taught no blocking, no wimping, no
mm-hmm.
gagging.
Mm-hmm.
And you sort of assume that this is the rule set, the foundation that it's all being built on. And then to have someone who saying, well, actually, no, we don't use that as a foundation. We use this. And Wade's been reading stacks of books from all over the world. And yeah, all these different foundations are a different set of skills. And I'm always quite fascinated to hear someone come along and go, oh, this rule that you learned, you can ignore that rule and do it a different way. And then suddenly you've got a whole range of other impressions that you're watching.
Well, yeah, what I was saying to you guys last night is that people get very hung up on the way they were first taught to improvise. And somebody said to me last night, oh, but I was always taught you can't block, therefore you can't question, therefore. And I was saying to him as well as to the rest of the group, the best way to proceed to develop as an improviser is not to really be so much beholden to what teachers have told you, but to watch the comedy that you love and assess principles from that. So if you love sitcoms and your favorite sitcom is Scrubs, what are they doing? If they're raising the stakes, if they're being massively affected. If you've been told never to ask a question, but JD always asks questions in Scrubs, then why are you following that rule? Because that's the comedy you love. And to start to get your principles from elsewhere, if you love The League of Gentlemen, if you love Monty Python, if you love whatever it is that you love, assess what it is that they're doing. And can you use those principles when you improvise?
Mm. We had a player who trained in America and had learned that if you have to do a scene change in a scene, that it's a failed scene. And so he would actively avoid leaving the stage even when someone else called a scene change. It was very, very confusing.
It's extraordinary. And that's because that's in his head. But of course, is a movie a failure because we have scene changes? No, it would be a failure if we didn't have any scene changes. It would be, not necessarily, but there are very few movies that don't have any scene changes. Very unusual movie that I think Alfred Hitchcock's Rope, but there's a reason why that's unusual. But in impro, he's been told, no, you must never have a scene change, so that's in his head now.
Mm-hmm.
But he's not going, well, yeah, but I love watching Frasier, it's my favourite sitcom, and they're always having scene changes.
Mm-hmm.
So why do we think in impro there are special rules that apply to us that don't apply to the rest of comedy and drama?
Mm.
There aren't. It's you can liberate yourself by assessing what is, instead of saying we mustn't do this and we mustn't do that, we mustn't do the other, look at the comedy that you love and assess positive principles. Do this, do this, do this, and then create your comedy through that. I think the big one is, that I talk about in the book, is that drama is usually people have extraordinary reactions to extraordinary circumstances. So your dad has died, your mother has married your uncle. You have a big reaction to that. You don't just say, well, you know, the main thing is I get on with my life and I go back and continue my studies and just put it behind me. You don't do that. You have an extraordinary mm-hmm. reaction, and you see the ghost of your father and you plot to kill your uncle. And, you know, it's a big old reaction. Comedy is people having extraordinary reactions to ordinary circumstances. So mm-hmm. In Friends, Joey's chair is broken and most of us would go, oh, well, things break, we buy a new chair. But Joey is devastated. This is his favourite chair. He has a name for the chair. We've never heard this before, but but he calls the chair Rosita. It's his favourite chair. It's his Barker lounger. What will he do without it? She's been like an old friend. He totally freaks out about it. Improvisation is normally people having ordinary reactions to extraordinary circumstances. So, oh, Bob, your mum's dead. Whatever. I hated her anyway. It's always people, like, not bothered about things. And it's too cool
for school.
Yeah, and it frustrates me because that's not what anyone else is doing. No one else is making a living out of not reacting. And, of course, even as I say that, you can think of examples where the opposite is true. Say, Flight of the Conchords.
Yep.
They are very much about the low reaction, the low reactors.
Oh, yeah.
But the thing is, actually, they are being affected. They're just keeping it close to them. So Jermaine will leave the band, and Brett will say, "Oh, that's right, Jermaine. Well, if that's what you want to do," and then he'll just mope around, and he's obviously absolutely devastated, but he won't admit it. And Jermaine's obviously absolutely devastated, but he won't admit it. And eventually, Jermaine will come back after they've both been through some tough times and go, "I thought I might come back to the band." And Brett will go, "Whatever. That's great. That's good with me, mate." You know, like, and it's just really under the radar. But it's kind of about blokes not showing their emotion, but feeling it very deeply.
Mm-hmm.
And so they're not, when they say, "I don't care," they don't actually not care. That's what's funny about it. They do care. Or the principal, the girl that Catherine Tate, who does the plays the character of the girl who says, I'm not bothered.
Yeah.
That's an example of not caring comedy. But actually, again, she is bothered, and that's why she's saying, "I'm not bothered," so many times. Also, she really winds other people up, so we do see people affected by her.
Yeah.
So wherever you can see comedy, you can basically see people being affected. Wherever you see drama, you see people being affected. It's one person changed by another in some way or another. And in improv, we tend to sort of go, we were talking about this last night, somebody wanting to operate by using jam, strawberry jam.
Yep.
And the other person going, "Sure, that's fine, yes, and not being affected by it in any way, mm-hmm. not saying, "But doctor, you know, this is going to hurt the patient," and being affected or changed by it. And of course, when we directed them to be affected and changed by it, the scene became really interesting and funny. But when you just keep going, "Yep, jam and the sugar, great, and cream, lovely," the audience is just sitting there thinking, why are you operating with jam and cream and sugar? That doesn't make any sense. And it's never justified, never explained, and no one's ever affected. So it's this comedy that's all on its own that the audience might laugh because it's very silly,
mm-hmm.
but it doesn't sustain anything. And improvisers think, like, for example, they've been told yes and, therefore they must yes and forever, despite what offer they're being given. And therefore their comedy is in a sort of a little pocket on its own. And I think that's sometimes why audiences are not as prolific for improvisation as they are for other genres, because that kind of thing is going on. And in general, where companies are being affected, the audiences tend to come if they're doing a good run of shows.
Well, not to be too sycophantic or anything, but your teaching and your couple of workshops I've done of yours have been some of my very favourites of impro.
Well, I love sycophancy, so that works out for me great.
I always come away and go, "I'm inspired to do these amazing scenes for the next 2 weeks, and then I'll forget it all and start go back to the cock jokes.
Go back to the old jam jokes.
Hooray! Now, let's find out a little bit more about you, so much as how did you get started in the whole entertainment industry and impro in specific?
Well, I did a lot of drama when I was a kid.
Yep.
And I actually came along to see Brisbane Theatre Sports shows because I was at... Brisbane Theatre Sports shows were on when I was like at high school and around that period at Le Boite Theatre.
All right. Well, there's a point of confusion here because you've got a British accent.
I have. Well, I went to Britain as soon as I grew up, as soon as I could, basically went to university there and never really came back. So.
Right. So you started in Australia.
Well, I also had quite a mild British accent. I had a rather mild Australian accent, so it wasn't very fast travel.
It'd be amusing if you had a mild British accent and people were just like, "Oh, we need to get it to London," so yeah, she stopped standing out.
Sure, sure. No, I had a very mild Australian accent.
Yep.
So, yeah, that explains that. And also, if you're in theatre in England, you don't want to always be endowed with being the Australian person.
Yeah.
So it's as well sound more neutral, because otherwise, if you're especially an improviser, you'll always be endowed with, "Oh, you're a local, you're an Australian traveller who haven't," you know. So I think I got right involved in the British community, and I wasn't hanging out in Elscourt with lots of Australians, so I ended up with an English accent pretty quickly.
Oh, yeah.
So, yeah, but I was really inspired by what was going on at Le Boite in the kind of golden age of Brisbane Theatre Sports.
Oh, okay.
And so when I went back in the day,
Adam Cooper and Tom Dunstan and
Andrew Buchanan and Roger Beams.
The Dinosaurs.
Well, if that's how you guys like to talk about them, I don't know. I'm not here anymore. I wouldn't like to say. But I did interview David Fenton from my book, and he was the MC of Theatre Sports in those days and a very brilliant man. And
he
now works in he's a professor at a university here in Brisbane,
mm-hmm.
And he gives an incredibly insightful interview. He's a genius, actually.
Oh, right.
And you have access to him right here in Brisbane. He could come and work with you guys, I'm sure, if he had time. And he's a brilliant man. And so I interviewed him because I really felt that there was something special about that time at Brisbane Theatre Sports.
Mm-hmm.
And when I went to London, the improvisation was a little bit, it was a bit gag gamey, a bit cabaret, a bit, it didn't really have the the weight that I think those La Boite shows had.
Oh, yeah.
And so I really wanted to work with someone that I felt would be able to show me that stuff. And I'd read Keith Johnston's Impro, of course. And so a lady came over called Patty Stiles. She came over from Canada, and she'd worked with Keith for many years.
Mm-hmm.
And she gave an amazing workshop. So I asked her to teach me secretly. We had the secret Impro group. I mean, it was just four of us.
Was this again in Melbourne or?
No, in London.
In London.
Yeah, oh, yeah. I moved to London as soon as I grew up, basically.
Okay,
so,
got it.
So she came to London and taught me to improvise. There were just four of us in a living room, and she worked with us for hours every week. We'd improvise till 2 o'clock in the morning, mm-hmm. and that was a very intense period of learning. Then I went over to work with Keith in Canada,
mm-hmm.
and spent some time over there, and came back, established the Spontaneity Shop, and have done shows for many years since in London, which have been fantastic. And yeah, I've had some lovely times doing improvisation. And we did a TV pilot called Dream Date, which was a romantic comedy format where we'd get a guy and a girl out of the audience, we'd interview them, and then we'd act out a romantic comedy based on what would happen if they met and fell in love, using actors to play them and their friends and family. And in between the scenes, we'd come back to them and say, okay, she hasn't called you, what are you going to do? And he'd say, well, I'd go to her work. And so the improvisers,
it's like an interactive choose your own adventure book,
kind of. Yeah, it's like when Harry Met Sally based on you know, and someone and a stranger you haven't met. And that was great because the improvisers really were truthful, because there were real people sitting there, and you can't really mess around and just be silly and make silly gags if there's a real person and they've given you real information about themselves. You have to take that information and make comedy out of it, but do so in a respectful way. So it really made our improvisers be more truthful in their work, and it was a really great time. We made the TV pilot. It's currently Fremantle Media's got the rights, who do Australian Idol and American Idol, to try and make it into a TV series. They've got the international rights. So it may yet be made. So we can't let anyone use the format at the moment because it's being developed.
It's
locked down, my friends. But it's a great format, and that was very exciting.
I hope that it works, because then we'll have another improvised show on television that we can bastardize for our posters. The amount of thank God you're there, or thank God you're hairy, or thank Impro you're here that have been going on.
Excellent.
Makes copywriting a breeze.
Excellent. And they don't try and take you down?
No.
Apparently,
no.
Idol people do. Apparently, if you call anything Australian Idol, apparently there's a show called Australian Idol, IDLE, which was taken to the cleaners.
Really? You'd think that would fall under some sort of parody.
Wouldn't
laws.
You? But wouldn't you? I don't know. I may be making that up. I heard that on the grapevine.
All right.
So just let's be careful about what I say.
Blanket there. Allegedly.
Allegedly.
Over the entire podcast.
I have no proof of that.
All podcasts, blanket allegedly.
Someone told me, and that means nothing. So there was that, and then we've developed various other formats. We took a show to Edinburgh this year. And out of that, I've become a screenwriter, and I wrote a romantic comedy screenplay with two friends, Philip Waller, who was in the Spontaneity Shop for many years, and Monica Henderson, who has also worked with the Spontaneity Shop, done workshops with us. She was a theatre director, and she's now a television writer in Los Angeles.
Oh, yeah.
And the three of us wrote a romantic comedy together, and it sold to Fox Searchlight. And so then we got a big agent, and we've been pitching Hollywood screenplays and writing another one now. We've got a couple of various projects in the works. So that's been really an exciting time. And that's directly come out of learning about story with improvisation and doing so many dream dates. So understanding what makes a romantic comedy work. Because I'm a big advocate of those principles that apply to screenwriting apply to improvisation. And I've been able to parlay that into some kind of screenwriting career. Very early days.
Mm-hmm.
But it's very exciting what we've been able to achieve in a short period of time. And how positive and open Hollywood is to us coming in and pitching ideas and reading our screenplays and things like that. So it's been exciting.
I never get that sense.
Oh, it's Hollywood. Massively open.
This
it's
notion that these
open.
People desperately trying to get things greenlit. And
oh, yeah. It's desperate. It's so open because they want good work. So they need to make money. And so there's that. And also through hosting improv shows and hosting Dream Date, I developed a stand-up persona and I started doing stand-up comedy. And I've done the Edinburgh Festival 3 times and the Melbourne Comedy Festival last year. I hope to go back next year.
Mm-hmm.
Someone asked me at Edinburgh this year if I would come and do Just for Laughs in Montreal, which would be exciting.
Oh,
and I've
lovely.
Done a UK tour, and I'm doing my show in Brisbane tonight, as we've talked about. So it's been lovely to have so many things come out of improvisation. And stand-up and screenwriting pay a lot better than improvisation. So it's been able to pay off in those ways. And also our book has been an exciting thing, an exciting project. And we've been able to really get a lot of our views off our chest and into a book. And hope people read it and use it and find it helpful.
And how are sales going?
Very well so far, yeah. Very well. But if you do buy the book and read it, then please leave a review on Amazon, the American Amazon site, because that helps us. The more ratings, the more the more it comes to the top. So please do read a, read the book and give it a review.
Lovely. The Spontaneity Shop in London, it's one of the biggest improv companies in London, is it?
Yes, it is the biggest improv company in London.
What's the landscape like?
Well, I mean,
like
you know, in as much as you can rate what's largest, I mean, I'm sure there are other companies that, that are also very functioning, do regular shows, have lots of people working for them. So I don't want to be in any way diminishing their work. There's lots of great improv companies
well,
in London.
Well, in Brisbane, we've got, I think, four improv groups, and they don't even really count as companies. But we've got the, all the dinosaurs who are working for the Sit Down Comedy Club doing a short form thing for 8 months a year in a stand-up venue. Then we've got Impro Mafia, who are doing our stuff in our couple of theatres. Then Edge Impro, who's rebuilding and got a couple of shows on in pubs. And then Playback Theatre, which is a different style of improv entirely, and I only heard about them a couple of months ago. I'm just wondering what it's like in London. Like, if you're an improviser in London, what are your options?
Well, the Spontaneity Shop have a very flourishing workshop program.
Yep.
And you can be in level one, two, or three, depending on your experience. And then we do regular shows with our core company of improvisers. And we often get improvisers from the RADA graduate program, or we teach at RADA from time to time. And we get actors who are very good performers who we then teach to improvise. Then there's there are some other companies. There's Sprout, who do workshops and shows, and there's Grand Theft Impro that is part of the Crunchy Frog Collective, and they in tandem do shows and workshops. And there are some other groups around the place that pop up and do shows in rooms above pubs, but I think Sprout and Crunchy Frog and the Spontaneity Shop are the most the longest running. There's also the Comedy Store Players, who have performed for many, many years at the Comedy Store on a Wednesday and a Sunday night, which Mike Myers started with Neil Malarkey and back in the day. And back in the early 80s, and they're still running. They're much more kind of comedy, pub prov, gag game type improvisation. They do the same show every week.
London was where Whose Line Is It Anyway was sort of started.
That's
up, wasn't
right, yeah, by Dan Patterson, who I know very well.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
It's very exciting.
I know, it's so exciting.
Getting all giddy and starstruck.
Yeah, so he's well, he rang me up once because he was interested in Dream Date, and I was like, oh my god, it's like having a phone call from the Steven Spielberg of improvisation. He's the only man that's ever made money out of it. And so we were in talks for a while about doing something together, and which we never did, but yeah, he's a nice chap.
And do you guys sort of associate with like Tony Slattery and Slattery, is it?
Tony Slattery, I know he's done a show with me, and Neil Malarkey, and to think of anyone else you might know. I've met Paul Merton a couple of times, but I don't really know him. I can't immediately think of anyone that you would know, that people would know who they were in Britain, but I don't think you would necessarily.
This is such a step up for us here on Anne's Time, because usually it's Nat or Greg dropping your name. Now you're dropping other people's names, aren't you?
It's just a big name drop fest.
Very exciting.
Presumably. Yeah.
I've got to meet more people.
Well, the Edinburgh Festival is a great place for that. The Edinburgh Festival is a great place for that, because if you are a performer there, you can hang out in the performers' bars and you can meet lots of fabulous people. You can meet.
Although I'd just be too cool.
I did bum a light from the Mitchell and Webb boys last festival. That was pretty exciting. I mean, I wouldn't say I know them, but a very good friend of mine was in there. A couple of my friends have been in Peep Show, which has been great. Do you know their sitcom called Peep Show?
Yes. Very keen on that one.
Yeah, that's lovely. And a friend of mine has just got a very funny show over there on ITV2 called Katie Brand's Big Ass Show. I went to university with Katie, and she's a good friend of mine, and she's got her own TV show. So check that out, download it. And because I don't know whether it'll come over to Australia or not, it might do.
All right.
That's a character comedy show. She does a very funny impersonation.
If it is, I'm sure it'll be on in the prime time spot of 2 a.m.
Sure.
On ABC2.
Oh, it won't be on ABC because it's ITV. So so check it out on download, and then start demanding your networks put it on. It's Katie Brand's Big Ass Show. Yeah, I mean, there are sort of other people that will hang out at Adam Hills, will hang out at the Melbourne Comedy Festival and the Edinburgh Comedy Festival. Mm-hmm. So he's a very nice man, and will always stop for a chat. So it's the festival's really where you meet people who will want to talk to other performers about what they're doing and
indeed
be sociable.
We had two celebrities at our festival that weren't actually in the show, which was very exciting, when Colin Lane from I Know and Woodley was there.
Oh, very exciting.
And one of the Umbilical Brothers, but I don't know which is which.
Sure.
So, and that's very exciting, and I said hello to each of them, but it was too cool. I was like, oh, hey, how are you? Right, I've got someone else to talk to.
Sure.
And then went and giggled in the bathrooms. So.
Sure. Well, I'm excited that you had these people at your festival. Will you do another festival like that again?
This one was our second one. I don't believe we're doing one next year because it's an enormous amount of work. And it was quite satisfying. But what we really need to do is focus on getting, making sure that our shows are the best quality they can be. And all these resources that goes into a festival could be better served making sure that our players and our shows are really starting to tick over and becoming worthwhile.
So maybe another festival 2010 after you guys have got yourselves on track.
Could be. I don't know. Talk to Wade. I don't touch the festivals. They sound like too much work to me.
They are.
I'm just the web guy.
Sure.
I get the feeling that, I mean, you're obviously an extremely competent improviser, and Nat and Greg, I love watching you in shows, and the one time I played with you, it was a delight. I'm sure at some point, just to allay the fears of some of the younger improvisers, that you've been in a couple of terrible shows.
Oh, extraordinarily bad shows.
Was there one specific moment that you felt was... The very bottom point of improv.
I've done so much terrible improv, and I remember saying to Patty once, who taught me, that I couldn't imagine her doing bad improv, and she was like, "Oh my god, I've done some terrible shows, some terrible improv." And it's what Patty said to me when I started learning with her was, 50% of the improv you ever do will be crap. Accept that now, or give up. And if you accept that, the other 50% might be wonderful, because you're going out to trust your obvious, to say yes. To be average and say yes. And you're not going out to be brilliant. And if you go out to be average and say yes, with our motto, we suck and we love to fail, then 50% of what you do might be liberated enough to be wonderful. But 50% of improvisation will always be terrible. Like, it will be. It's just, it's an art form that relies on the audience thinking, God, are they going to get it right? Are they going to get through it? Sometimes you're going to crash and burn. But ideally, to be entertaining to the audience, you'll crash and burn in a spectacular fashion. And then you'll be soaring like an eagle the other half of the time. Oh, I the show that I really, really shudder at is that we had an all-girl show that was a monthly show for a different women's charity every month. And it was called Hell on Heels. And yep. It was a great show. It was just such a kicking show, and everyone had such a good time doing it. And we had these great women coming to do this show. There was about 10 of us, and we'd just crowd onto the stage and do this fabulous show. And we have a female guest celebrity who would tell stories from her life, and we would improvise based on what she'd said.
Oh, okay, yeah.
And it was such a wonderful show. And I'd been trying to get Bruce Dessau, who was the Evening Standard comedy critic, which is a newspaper that's very influential in Britain, in London. And I'd been trying to get him to come, and he really loved our stuff and had always been very sweet when he mm-hmm. reviewed us before. And I said, look, Bruce, this is a great show. If you come to this show, and I knew Hell on Heels was only ever good or great. It was never bad. It was just joyful, and the audience loved it. And it was monthly. It had the celebrity attached. It had the charity attached. So it was always full.
Mm-hmm.
It was always successful. And so there was always a good spirit in the room before we began. Yep. So we just always had great shows. And so one day he rang me and said, I'm coming tonight.
Yep.
And I thought, okay, that's great. That's very exciting. And our celebrity guest was Tara, who had come from New York, and she works with Mike Myers in New York. So we'd used her. Normally we'd have a British celebrity, mm-hmm. but we thought we'll just have Tara come. And Tara wanted to improvise as well as doing the monologue, so we were doing it a little bit differently, and that was fine. And that was all good. And then we got into the room, and it was so hot. It was baking hot. Ooh. Absolutely. It was the hottest day of the year. It was the hottest day I can ever remember in London. And it was this room above a pub, and it really wasn't created for the heat. I mean, London pubs are created to keep heat in. And
so I was doing a bang-up job of that, I imagine.
Absolutely. I mean, the audience were dying. And there were too many people in there. It was overly full.
Uh-huh.
And it was just, people were dying with the heat. And it felt like improvising in treacle. And it was the worst show, not only I've ever been in, but I've ever seen. It was just, there was no one could redeem it. And there were always, you know, there's certain people in our group that, you know, they could always come out and save something if something's going awry, and, you know, you could go out and be the lifeline and, you know, be affected,
mm-hmm.
raise the stakes, you know. And for whatever reason, nothing anyone was doing was working, and I just felt like I'd never improvised before. Like, I was improvising with my limbs sellotaped to my body. I just felt like I didn't know anything about improvisation. It was bizarre. And the show was dire. And Bruce very sweetly wrote a review, which I was so gutted, and because I was like, it's never been bad. I don't understand. It's only ever been great. But it was so hot. And Bruce sweetly wrote a review which said it was just too hot in there. It was overly full. I've seen them before. They're great. Give them another chance next month, you know, because I know the Spontaneity Shop are great, but this was not their finest hour sort of thing, which is a very generous review because he could have just slated it. And I texted him saying, thanks so much for coming. As you can imagine, that was not the show I wanted you to see. That's not what I've been raving about for 12 months, sort of thing. Anyway, so that was my worst impro story.
Oh,
it was a tough night. But you know, that's what impro is. It is like that. Like, and next month it was great again. You know, and that's,
if you don't get the failures, you don't get the joy from the success.
Absolutely, and it's partly, you know, if you wanted to do something safe, you'd script it. Like my stand-up show, I'll have, you know, good nights and great nights and whatever, but I know there's a certain amount of written material in there that's funny and that's always works. And there's really only, even if you're off and the audience aren't in the mood and they're not sitting in the right spot and they've come pissed off and the room's too hot, there's a certain amount of material in that show which mm-hmm. is going to work because, yeah. touch wood, I say that before I do the show tonight, but it's going to work because it's crafted jokes. So even if they're not laughing as much as normal or even if I'm not having a great night, there's a certain amount of stuff there that will be funny and will work.
Yeah.
And so I kind of know where I am with stand-ups, which is safe. It's safer. And so when you say I had a bad stand-up gig, it's never really in the league, I mean, for me anyway, of a bad improv gig. But that's why we do improv. It's exciting and you don't know what's going to happen and it's liberating and brilliant. But it's never, ever, ever going to be a safe. And if you, while we continue to create forms and games and companies that are all about making improv more safe, we will never find its brilliance because we need to make it more dangerous.
I see. I always find stand-up to be entirely risky because I've got things that I can forget. With impro, I'm on stage and whatever I say has to be right because it's impro.
Sure, that is true. That's another way of looking at it. But basically, once you know your material, it's true. It's true.
This and some is
people
the problem.
Some people find stand-up terrifying, and of course, that's just from my point of view. But certainly, improv shouldn't be. We shouldn't be trying to make our improvisation safer.
No,
it's not. It's what most improv companies do. We did that show last year. That worked really well. We know that format. Why are we changing it? It's all about trying to make it safer because it's a dangerous art form. But we should be about making it more dangerous.
Indeed. Deborah Francis White, thank you very much.
You're very welcome. Thanks for having me.
And time. Deb has written the book Improv Everywhere.
The Improv Guide to Improv. Stop it. You're just confusing them.
Okay.
The book is called The Improv Handbook. And it is available on Amazon and in some bookshops. But the easiest way to get it is on Amazon.
Excellent. My website is invisiblespiders.com. It's almost ready, people. For news about Impro in Brisbane, go to impromafia.com. Thanks to David Peachy for our theme music. Hosting for End Time is charmingly provided by Civic Net Web Design. It'll please some of the people who want a bit more impro in their podcast.
Excellent.
As opposed to the tangents that Matt and I tend to spread off on.